Hello and welcome to the Squawker Talker Football Podcast. Our sponsors are BetBall, and if you are over 18 and gambling responsibly, please download their app and check them out. My name is Sam Long and I'm your caretaker host. Jake Entwistle is once again off. If he's not back soon, then I'll be staking a claim for a permanent deal. Today I'm joined by Squawker editor Will Hall. How are you, Will?
I'm not too bad. Thank you for asking. After the loneliness of recording the intro to Monday's bonus app, which you should listen to if you haven't already.
Well, talking of that, also here is chief writer Mohammed Butt. How are you, Mo?
I'm all right. Glad to be back on the pod. Missed it last week. I was at home enjoying myself. I was like, oh, I wish I was on the pod today.
We miss you too, mate.
No, you don't.
So the international break is quickly fading into the distance and the Premier League is back. Of course, there is only one place to start. Well, we thought the place to start was going to be Man City versus Chelsea until Spurs decided to sack Mauricio Pochettino and hire Jose Mourinho in the space of 11 crazy hours.
Really convenient hour slots.
Spurs Twitter is like one tweet at like 11 PM, a club statement, and then it's linked to Spurs sack Pochettino, and then literally 2 hours like club statement.
Club statement with the ominous cockerel looking over the stadium when you know something serious. So obviously Mourinho in at Spurs just in time for Panto season. That we've got our villain back with a new stage. Sign a new contract until the end of the 22-23 season, and has been given the task of re-energising a Spurs squad with just 3 wins from their opening 12 Premier League games. So it's fair to say that Mourinho's arrival was already proven to be divisive, I should say, as is always the case when he's involved. Some fans are pining for Poch's return and question Mourinho's style of play, while plenty of others are now starting to turn and embrace the new era, despite some reservations about his style of play. There's suddenly a lot of question marks over the future of Spurs' key players, and Mourinho's definitely going to want some funds in January. So I wanted to kick off by asking, which realistic January signing do we think would be the most quintessential signing for Mourinho? Will, I'll go to you first.
Only Norwich have faced more shots on target than Spurs this season, which underlines their major issue. They've been awful defensively.
They have.
But I think Mourinho is capable and potentially willing to address the major issue of the defence with what he's got through tactical means. Suggestions have already been bandied about the office as to whether he'll move Eric Dier to centre-back or a potential Wanyama renaissance. Those kind of manoeuvres, tactically speaking, you would imagine result in fewer attacks, which is why Mourinho will want an instinctive goal scorer in midfield. And Bruno Fernandes is a player he's publicly described as such before. And putting aside, so as for whether he's a realistic target, I think we kind of need to put aside the hugely believable reports saying that Daniel Levy has already told me there's no money to spend in January. But in terms of why I think Fernandes is a gettable purchase, he said in an interview with, I think, Portugal's branch of GQ this summer that he already agreed to join Spurs in the summer, but I think the goalposts were moved with regards to the transfer fee Sporting were asking for. And Mourinho is also on record as a fan, as I said previously, just a second ago. He's publicly described Fernandes as he's put on record his admiration for Fernandes' ability to score goals, etc. Sporting are 10 points behind first place Benfica in the Primeira Liga at the moment. And reports say their financial situation has left them open to selling this time. And thirdly, I think I'm right in saying that his agent is Jorge Mendes.
Oh, of course.
So the deal is done. The usual suspect when it comes to Mourinho buys.
Mo, what about you?
They don't have any money. Bruno Fernandes in the summer? Yeah, okay. I believe that the rumours, the word that they don't have any money because Mourinho's talking about young players. I want to play young players. No, you don't. You never have in your life.
About the 50 players he gave debuts to in his career that he claimed when he... That was in his Man United unveiling.
Yeah, I love that because it was like he played them once and off they went. Like there's like a handful of young players that he's genuinely trusted.
And what about Manager's Player of the Year, Scott McTominay,
which is a propaganda slap. Basically, it's Raphael Varane, Davide Santon, Raphael Varane, and like Kurt Zouma. That he's genuinely really trusted, like teenagers. And he wanted to trust Balotelli, but Balotelli was too volatile at that age. You know, he doesn't tend to trust young players. And I suppose McTominay, if you really want to go there. and Rashford. Actually, yeah, Rashford, to be fair. So it's a handful of guys. I think Mario Mandzukic, on loan from Juventus. The Juventus don't need him. They don't have room for him. They're trying to squeeze everyone into their squad. I don't think he's even in their Champions League squad. They've got Dybala, Cristiano Ronaldo. Gonzalo Higuain's having a semi-renaissance over there. They've got they've got a lot of players up front. You know, they don't have room for Mandzukic. He's still there. He wouldn't cost money because you get him on loan. You can have him on loan with maybe an option to buy in the summer or whatever. And he is the fabled backup for Harry Kane. And not only that, he's really mean and nasty. And that's just exactly the kind of player Mourinho loves to have. And, you know, he's a worker. That's the other thing. Like, because... obviously, the whole problem with having a backup Harry Kane is, what do you do when Harry Kane's always fit? Well, you can play Mandzukic left wing, as Juventus has shown, and I think Mourinho would adore that. Imagine playing a giant like Mandzukic left wing and just having like whoever's playing right back or like Eriksen or Dele Alli peeling into that right flank and just pinging crosses to him at the back post all day long.
So he's going to drop Heung-min Son?
Well, maybe Son goes on the right wing, I don't know. But I'm just saying, you can play Mandzukic wide. You can play him in other positions other than up front. I think he's the perfect... He's pure Mourinho in terms of his profile and the way he plays. And he's free because he'd be on loan. And, you know, it's the backup for Kane that the squad doesn't have. Because, you know, if Kane's not scoring, you have to go with no forward, and that's not a Mourinho style. So
Fair.
We were talking behind your back yesterday.
Sounds about right.
And decided... and decided you were going to say Zlatan Ibrahimovic.
Believe me, the temptation to put Zlatan Ibrahimovic here was enormous, but I don't think it will happen because let's just be honest, a club like Spurs is, with all due respect, below the ego of Zlatan Ibrahimovic. He would not come to a club that has no chance of winning anything this season. His whole
Champions League.
They're not going to win the Champions League. His whole thing is the self-aggrandizing propaganda. That's partly why he went to LA when he did, because it's an easy win. He knew he could dominate the league, and he did. He did brilliantly. He went to Man United thinking, I can rescue Man United, and he sort of did in his first year. If injury hadn't hit, who knows how far he could have taken them. I mean, not much further, but, you know, they could have been better than they ended up being. So I think... I was very tempted, but I just think... Got
think
to be
of
realistic.
All Harry Kane could learn under the wing of Ibrahimovic.
he'd just start
gazing from the bench.
He would definitely fight Serge Aurier at some point and probably beat him up, which would be amusing, I guess. But yeah, no.
I think the first area that he's going to look to address is at centre-back. So I've picked Koulibaly, mainly because I haven't ruled out... Which not a lot of people.
Yeah, you really stretched the definition of realistic.
No, see, I don't think it is. It's not.
Yeah, I guess they're
beyond the realms of possibility.
The controversy they've had with the player strike, I should maybe not say, but with the training camp that they tried to force on the players and the players walked away, created a situation certainly there.
I just think that Mourinho, having spent so long at Man United whinging about needing a centre back. I expect him to sign a big centre-back that he wanted and then give two fingers to Ed Woodward.
But then did he not try and sign Alderweireld as one of the centre-backs? Like, now he's got him.
I think he's actually going to let Alderweireld go, because if Alderweireld was going to sign a new deal, I think it's purely about money for Alderweireld. He's looking for that final big deal that he hasn't sort of quite got in his career yet.
It's possible, but I just think, to me, Alderweireld and Vertonghen are so, they're veterans, they're proven, and I mean the problem was that they just got tired and unfocused under Pochettino, and yeah, they wanted the new deals and they weren't going to get them, and Pochettino's approach to that was just get out of the team. Then I think Mourinho is much more pragmatic than Poch. I think he won't care one jot if they're going to leave in the summer, because I think ultimately he's all about the short-term game. He knows his job depends on Spurs getting fourth, and Alderweireld is a brilliant defender, and so is Vertonghen. I think he'd play both of them. I think maybe he'll move Dier back, as we've said before. I think Davinson Sanchez makes way too many mistakes to really be given a full-on go under Mourinho until he's really absorbed the the Mourinho doctrine, as it were, of defending. I think Juanfort is a nail on shot for right back. He'll be there. He'll be their right back every game. He's massive.
You don't think he's going to fancy Serge Aurier?
No. No. He's not. The thing with Aurier is, right, he's unpredictable. If he was predictable and still, you know, Mourinho doesn't like unpredictability, right? He plays Ashley Young at fullback constantly because it's just like you get a reliable 7 out of 10 there, you know? You might get a 9 out of 10. You might get an 8 out of 10, but then you might also get a 3, you know? It's like Mourinho can't afford to have that sort of shakiness on his CV. I mean, he'd be really lamenting that Trippier left because Trippier is pure Mourinho as well. I think Juanfort at right back, a bit like Branislav Ivanovic, just a big dude, helps the side defensively, gives maybe a bit more license for Danny Rose to just bomb. He's going to love Danny Rose.
He tried to sign Danny Rose at United.
Yeah, and Danny Rose is a fierce competitor. Even when Spurs were falling apart on the pitch, he was constantly giving it his all. So I think he's going to love Danny Rose. Wanyama, if he's fit, I think straight back in the side. I mean,
you reckon?
Yeah, he's an amazing defensive midfielder. He can't.
Wanyama has been rubbish for a long time.
I know that. But he can't pass the ball very well at all. But as a pure defender, my goodness, he's something else. And I think Mourinho will be like, right, you're massive. Get in the team. Remember, this is the guy who played Matic. And Matic couldn't do anything with the ball, but like was just.
Well, I'm surprised no one said Matic for the January signing.
I think because he has Wanyama. I think Wanyama is perfect for what he needs to put in there. Wanyama, Winks, Sissoko. That's a Mourinho midfield 3 or 5. I saw one.
What about Ndombele?
He'll play him as a. Oh god, yeah.
He's definitely playing Ndombele.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, yeah. Goodness. Well, maybe Sissoko. Maybe Sissoko on the wing.
I think Winks will be the man to drop out. So Spurs are already 11 points off the top four pace. But where do we think they're going to end up finishing this season? Is Mourinho going to get his new manager bounce, or is the top four race already run?
I think fifth is the safest prediction.
I thought you were going to say second, then.
Yeah.
It's got to be sixth, isn't it?
I had the word safe in my head, as I do while making many predictions, and then got them jumbled. But I wouldn't be surprised to see either Chelsea or Leicester hit a really bad run of form. More so Chelsea, because that's part of the natural process when you have a new manager, I think. Sarri had a great start to last season and then remember what happened there. But I think it's too bold and baseless to predict Spurs will make up 12 points on those two teams who have really been impressive, who have been so impressive this far this season. And then City obviously are the team in fourth who are 11 points above them, but I don't think Rooney is going to catch City. I think City will recover
The thing with Leicester is obviously it's their performance right now. They're playing amazing football, but it's all based on Jamie Vardy's ridiculous conversion rate, which probably isn't going to last.
There are certain underlying numbers with Leicester's performances that are really good. I don't have them here, but I think defensively
they're a very good team. But I just ultimately when your striker's operating with a 50% conversion rate or something like that, that's not going to last over a season. And so, like you said, they'll hit a run of form, they'll drop down. But I think the top four is mostly as it is. Not they're not in that order, right order. But I think that they'll be the top four. Maybe United could get in with a shout if Martial and Rashford can stay fit all season. But so I think they're the top five of the league right there. The top four currently, and then Man United, and I think Chelsea will finish sixth. I think they'll make up Chelsea, Spurs, Mourinho, clubs across. I think two of them finish sixth. They'll make up the points. They've got an amazing first 11. Still, their squad is a bit. I don't know. Who knows? But you know, if you keep Harry Kane fit and Son fit, and if you can reintegrate Christian Eriksen, which I think is big, or just getting Dobby. I mean, RIP Lo Celso, poor guy. He's not going to see any minutes. But you know, there's definitely players there who can lift Spurs. The Spurs are way better than they have been. So I think Spurs will finish sixth because they've just got a bit too much makeup. I think the top four plus United will pull away. Arsenal, goodness knows. They'll go ahead of Arsenal just to really. And then Emery will get sacked. So that'll be what it takes.
I think they'll finish fifth as well. I can see fifth as well.
Fifth is a hard word to say.
Clearly, yes.
I can see Mourinho getting the upturn in results, but not enough to bridge the gap. I just think the squad's going to be, it's in such a state of flux. There's too many players who are thinking about leaving, or now there'll be different players thinking of leaving because Mourinho's coming in. Because so say they do, they're too far off in sort of December before the January transfer window, then all the speculations that's going to come in January is going to be even more distracting. So we talked about Alderweireld, Vertonghen, they could be negotiating with new clubs in January, and they'll be wanting to do that if they're thinking in the back of their minds, we're not going to get in the top
four. Juventus will definitely be in talks with someone at Spurs.
And then the same if it gets to like March or sort of February time and they start to fall away and it doesn't look like top four, then all the transfer talk's going to ramp up, because realistically, if they're not going to be finishing the top four, then Kane has got to be thinking about leaving. Oh, and that will turn into a huge story that will sort of be overshadowing everything that Mourinho's trying to do.
I mean, there's no way. Like you said, that you're absolutely right, because Harry Kane is too good to play in the Europa League. Unless you pay him like absurd amounts of money. Like, United overpaid Pogba, like, with him a huge contract to play in the Europa League, basically, effectively. Spurs aren't going to do that to Kane. And the two biggest clubs in the world basically need a striker this summer, Barcelona and Real Madrid. At some point, you know, they're going to be like, oh, Harry, hey, how you doing? And it's and then Spurs are going to be like, well, okay, can we convince this guy not to go? Like, without Champions League football, he's too good to play in the Europa League. He's one of the two best strikers in the world right now. That's a big problem. That's why he's been talking up Harry Kane already. Apparently, there's leaks that he says, oh, Kane's the best striker. He's been telling him already. He's got to get Kane on side, because they ain't making top four. And if they don't make top four and they don't win the Champions League, they're not in the Champions League next year. And then, I mean,
it's going to be all eyes on the FA Cup.
The timing of the sacking suggests that Daniel Levy isn't willing to write this season off.
Yeah, obviously.
So I think, and I did read somewhere that they expect him to get into that top four.
That's very ambitious.
I mean, I think it's sensible to assume they won't, because of the points differential, which is reflected in all of our predictions. But that makes it even more interesting to consider how well they're doing in the Champions League. Which is, I mean, no one really considers them big contenders for that, but you do see a trend of like teams performing well one season and then replicating that in the next, as we saw with Liverpool getting to the final, Real Madrid getting to so many finals. I think that experience of going through the process all the way to the end serves teams well from a psychological point of view. And then, of course, there's the FA Cup, which is yet to start, and you can't really make too many projections on a competition that hasn't yet seen a draw involving Premier League clubs yet.
I was going to say it has started. Some people's teams are already out.
I could sense the disappointment in your expression. Quickly corrected what I was saying. But the FA Cup seems to be. If Mourinho is going to win a trophy with Spurs, FA Cup seems most realistic, based on how difficult the Champions League is to win. And if he does win a trophy with Spurs, the photos of the trophy race is what we're going to associate this team, which is just Pochettino's team, and yet the photos are all going to be Mourinho.
Poor old Poch.
Exactly. I think it's a bit of a tragedy, really, if Spurs do now win a trophy.
I think he's
not that Spurs fans will probably see it that way.
I think Pochettino deserved to finish off the project. Have him in the man who sort of didn't have money to spend and had to stay when. They were playing at Wembley for two seasons to not sort of have to put the cherry on top of the cake, as it were.
His body language and the things he was saying that suggested that he was laying the groundwork for a departure.
You could see after the Ajax win that it was emotionally, it was such a high getting to the Champions League final. That was it, I think. I don't think it was ever going to come back. Win or lose, he was never going to come back from that to be able to manage them again. They should have parted ways in the summer, in all honesty. That should have been the sensible play.
No, I'm not sure necessarily if he had to go in the summer. I think it was more that they didn't get the changes that they needed in the summer.
Oh, yeah,
they needed to sell Ericsson. They needed to make the decisions on all the players who they've been trying to shift for three, four, five transfer windows.
If you go by Danny Rose's comments, they tried. But in Rose's case, he was just unwilling to move, which is fair enough. He's on a contract there. And speaking of contracts, I think that's why he was sacked, because there was no way. And this isn't a criticism at all, but there's no one in football, I think, who's noble enough to forgo that. I think it was like £12 million payoff. You'd be out of your mind to resign, even if you kind of were sat in a room with Levy and Levy saying, we know you don't really want to be here anymore and things are going badly. But that's why I don't feel too sorry for him.
No, he's got a big payoff.
He's still a multi-millionaire.
and he'll walk into a top job right now. There's Bayern Munich are not settled.
Exactly. Yeah.
There's PSG who probably will sack Tuchel if they don't win the Champions League this year, which they won't. Well, maybe they will. Who the hell knows? And then Man United have always been eyeing up Pochettino. You know, you stick Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as director of football. He's a nice yes man for the Glazers. You know, and everybody. He won't cause too many waves. He's clearly good at identifying talent.
I think Pochettino would be turfing Ole out though if he got the job.
No, I think you put Ole upstairs. Ole and Poch will work together. That'll be how you sell it. Because you don't want to sack Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. That's a huge fan. Be like, what are you doing? He's great.
It would seem a bit random to just put Solskjaer in a director of football.
Yeah, but if you look at it, though, it's an easy win for the Glazers. Because then, finally, we have director of football. Shut up, guys. We have one. And then also, you know, he's the fans love him. And he's clearly shown an eye for talent. And he could easily... He's more about the big picture anyway than actual training, I think. If you listen to the way he talks and what he talks about. So I mean, he could easily work with Poch. Poch is a genius anyway. I mean, you give Poch any sort of team, he'll make amazing things out of them. He's a great coach.
So moving on from the Mourinho managerial talk, Spurs have to actually play a football match this weekend. They face West Ham at the London Stadium in Saturday's early kickoff. West Ham obviously bang out of form themselves. Manuel Pellegrini facing a lot of pressure. So how do we think the game is actually going to go?
I reckon, I mean, Mourinho's always had an adversarial relationship with Pellegrini. I think he's going to relish the big new manager bounce. He'll come in and they'll get a big win, I think. It'll be a big sort of statement, maybe like 4-1, something like that. Really, really big win. Harry Kane maybe will back. He's in great form right now playing for England. He might back a hat-trick or something like that. Something really dramatic. And it'll be like, oh, snap. Like, you know, and it'll be like, Mourinho's back, everybody. And it'll be all hype. And obviously, that will eventually dissipate and everything. But I think the first game, West Ham, I mean, Squawker's own West Ham fan, Tom Green, was saying to me, we're going to get smashed. Yeah, he was saying that. So, you know, and if he's thinking that, I think it's probably like West Ham aren't playing well as well, obviously. And
the tweet is going to give him extra incentive to win as well.
The poor admin who spent his day making that video tweeted it and then had to delete it after about an hour. It's just, ouch. But... West Ham seem to have Spurs' number when it matters, though. You think as recently as last season when they became the first team to win at the new stadium. Mm. And then 2015-16, I think, when Antonio's header won in the game.
Yeah.
And Spurs actually missed the chance to go top that night. So it's whenever the narrative seems to be going towards a Spurs win, West Ham seem to...
It's their biggest London rivalry. Or biggest London derby, you would say. And they do say about derbies, the form book goes out the window.
They're both in terrible form, so it's...
So, exactly.
Yeah.
And then Jose Mourinho coming in. If you go by the colour pieces that were written, assessing what the mood was like at Spurs in those final weeks before Pochettino was sacked, sounds like the players were really unhappy under Pochettino, who they saw as being too demanding and like trying the same things over and over again, repeating the same instructions and just being bewildered when they failed to carry them out. So there's that sense in which he lost the dressing room, and perhaps the new manager coming in just instantly eradicates that psychological problem. So given that if that is no longer an issue... On paper, Spurs are a better team, so you'd expect them to win this game.
Okay, that's enough about West Ham and Spurs. We're going to take a quick break before we turn our attentions to another London club who have the small matter of a trip to the Etihad Stadium on Saturday evening. Chelsea are 1 point ahead of reigning champions Manchester City, who find themselves languishing in fourth place. And frankly, they should be ashamed of themselves. No, seriously, Man City don't seem to be assured of a runners-up place any longer. And if they lose to Frank Lampard's likeable Chelsea, as they're being dubbed, they could end up finishing the weekend 12 points off top spot if other results don't go their way. So we've put our heads together and we've come up with five things that we think are going to happen during Saturday's game. And Mo, you're going to kick us off with a Chelsea-related nugget.
Mateo Kovacic is going to score. He hasn't scored since 29th of January 2017.
Solid.
That was 1,028 days ago.
He's due one then.
In the 3-0 home win against the Real Sociedad for Real Madrid. And he's going to score again. Not only is he going to score again, he's going to score the same kind of goal. In that game, he ran from midfield. Cristiano Ronaldo had the ball, ran into the number 10 slot, pulled a defender out, obviously because he marked him, and he just slipped the ball in behind. Very nice pass. Kovacic ran through, controlled it, finished it. Nice side foot finish. I think he's going to do the same thing at City. I think Fernandinho is not a centre-back. Correct. Otamendi is not a good centre-back. So I think what will happen is at some point, one of the Chelsea players, Mason Mount, Tammy Abraham, whoever it is, will get the ball in that space, and then one of the centre-backs will come out to try and mark him because they're stupid, and he'll slip a ball in behind Mateo Kovacic, is running through, you know, because he's been playing really well this season, playing really, really solid.
So do you think it's going to be him and Jorginho?
Yeah, I think so. Or maybe we'll see the old Mauricio Sarri sub. Maybe he won't start because obviously Kante is probably fit again now, right? So maybe he plays Kante and Jorginho, and then it's like, oh no, let's get because the thing is, Jorginho and Kovacic really work as a duo. Right? They cover each other's weaknesses. They really help keep possession, which I think actually is probably City's best chance to actually unnerve. Chelsea's best chance to unnerve City, but more on that later. I think whether he starts or comes off the bench, I think he will score, and he will score a kind of goal like he did against Real Sociedad, where he runs from deep, gets a nice pass through, controls it, and finishes it very calmly, because he's having a great season. I think, you know, it's about goddamn time, isn't it?
I mean, yes. How many days is it? 1,000?
1,028 days.
Definitely due one.
Solid reasoning.
So my first prediction may not sound too revolutionary.
Why?
But it feeds into a bit of a bigger narrative, and that is I am backing De Bruyne to provide an assist.
Well, steady on, mate.
Which will take his tally up to 10 for the season. So reaching double figures after just 13 games will make him the third quickest player to do so in a season in Premier League history. So Cesc Fabregas and Mesut Ozil are the two other players to reach the 10 milestone faster than De Bruyne. Hypothetically, of course.
Shout out Jake Rentwistle.
And of course, they're the two players who went closest to breaking Henry's long-standing record of 20. They finish up with 18 and 19 respectively after tailing off during the second half of the season. But De Bruyne is still well on track to break it, particularly when you look at how strongly he finished that season when he won the first Cadbury's Playmaker Award. Yeah.
You want a year's supply of chocolate.
Well, I always think they missed a trick with that they should have called it the Curly Whirly Award.
Why?
Because he's curling crosses into the box instead of Cadbury. Okay. But anyway.
That's amazing.
We'll leave the chocolate talk. Yeah, so I had another final bit of trivia on the assists, okay. Which was, so Ozil, Fabregas, Henry, and De Bruyne himself, obviously, plus one more player has provided 18 assists in a single Premier League season. Do you know who it is?
So it's four in total, and three of those are De Bruyne, Henry, and Fabregas.
And Ozil.
Okay.
And there's one more.
So who's the fifth?
And he's involved at the Etihad this week. End. Which is a clue, cryptic clue.
Oh, Frank Lampard.
Frank Lampard. Okay. 04-05.
Yeah.
He was like 18 assists. That's impressive because he scored like 15 goals that season, or something like that. That's impressive. He's an impressive player. He was an impressive player.
It's the Frank Lampard derby this weekend as well, lest we forget.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Traitor or legend, depending on what side of the fence you're on.
Do you want my prediction now?
I would love your prediction.
Similarly ambitious, Sergio Aguero. Whoa. To score.
Steady on.
Right, but this is I like this one because it's got a lot of narrative.
All right, here we go.
Aguero has more goals against Chelsea than he does against any other opponent, according to Transfer Market, who have him on 15 goals in 18 games across all competitions, I believe, against Chelsea, which is a good record against
Chelsea. He scored against tough opposition. Atletico Madrid as well, didn't he, in the Champions League?
But here is where me and Sam have been a little bit crafty and synergised our predictions, because De Bruyne to Aguero is the joint most frequent assist provider to goal scorer combination in the Premier League so far this season, having yielded three goals. So that makes sense, what I've said there. Because it was a mouthful. Cool. And to wrap up this prediction with a little bit more flavour, it was reported this week by The Athletic, I think, that John Terry convinced Chelsea not to sign Aguero way back before we moved to City. I mentioned earlier that Chelsea is the opponent he has scored against more often than anyone else. He has, in fact, scored more goals against them than any other player in Premier League history, with 10. Oh, wow. And has eight goals in his last six matches. So Terry stopped Chelsea signing the player who would go on to become the most effective goal scorer against them in the Premier League ever.
John Terry, mate. What a Chelsea legend.
JT, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah.
So now Lampard's going to have to make up for his deal with his mess this Saturday.
That's even better than Ryan Giggs convincing Man United not to sign Thiago.
Oh, because he's not a Manchester United player.
Yeah.
God, that was such
That was bad because Man United have been terrible since. But I mean, Aguero has literally been one of the best strikers in Premier League history.
To be a bit balanced, we should maybe say that I think both of these things are like off the record reporting, but rumours of what happened.
PSA.
We don't know the full story.
But it does make sense because I remember Aguero was linked with Chelsea for ages before he went, and everyone was like, oh, he's going to Chelsea, he's going to Chelsea. And then he went to City and it was just like that.
I want both of them to be true though.
It would be pretty funny. My prediction feels really weird now because I was just like completely out there. You guys are like, Aguero.
That's what happens when you take holiday, Mo.
Yeah, I know. Selfish me.
So a second prediction from you, please. Then.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, well.
Don't rest on your laurels there. We need a second one.
Well, okay.
Because we've got five total.
Well, Kovacic is obviously going to score, right? He's going to take the lead. And then I think your synergistic magic is going to happen.
De Bruyne sets up Aguero.
Yeah, I think that's going to happen. It's going to be 1-1. But I think City are going to get the winner and it's going to be late. It's going to be I think Chelsea, as I said before, I think they're going to either they start it or they switch to it. They'll have Jorginho and Kovacic at the base of midfield. And I think what they will do is they'll try and play City their own game. And I think it will take City by such surprise that, okay, this team's actually good at passing. Because that occasion that happens to Pep's sides is they come up against a team who can actually play. And for a little while in the game, it's like, whoa, what the hell? And they get sort of disconcerted because they can't really play on the back foot, Pep's sides. They're never really built to do that. And so if you can press them a little bit and actually play your own game, you can get some joy. You know, and eventually what usually happens is they assert themselves and then they take over and then they beat you. And I think that will happen again, but I do think Chelsea will, like I said, either they'll start with it or they'll bring him on, Kovacic, to, you know, replace Kante. And they'll have more joy doing that because I think if they have Kante on, they're just going to be sort of almost in containment mode, playing on the break like they were against Liverpool in Super Cup. And I think that's just City are going to have fun doing that. They'll dominate. But I think when they bring on Jorginho and actually try and play Chelsea City their own game, it will be like, whoa, hang on a minute. And I think they'll score. And I think that, but then City will rally. They'll get their equaliser through your little synergy. And they'll go and they will win it right near the end. It will look like City going to drop points, you know, and that will be a tragedy because obviously Liverpool are going to drop points against Palace. Heard it here first. And it'll be like, oh, City going to miss the chance to close the gap. And then up pops, who else but Raheem Sterling, man of the moment. You know,
it'll be interesting to see
if
he plays Reece James at right back or Azpilicueta.
I think that would be Azpilicueta. Nice.
You'd have thought so, wouldn't you?
Mm. So we were meant to sync up all our predictions, but I guess it's good to have balance. But your one conflicts with the scoreline. I think Sam as well, because we were talking off air about this as well. But
I've gone for a draw, yeah.
Yeah, interesting that you say about how Chelsea will be in containment mode. Because I have two sort of gut level theories, is maybe a bit of a grandiose term for these, but I guess I can go along with it for now. But theories on this game. First is that Chelsea don't match the profile of teams who have won league games away to Guardiola City in the past. But the past also suggests now is the best time to beat Guardiola City at the Etihad. Because I think in this game, the tactical edge goes to City. This will be the case more often than not when you're managed by Pep Guardiola, of course. But here's another question, actually. Can you guys name the four teams who have beaten Man City at the Etihad since Guardiola took over?
Crystal Palace.
Yeah.
Sure.
Townsend. Is it Champions League as well?
No, Premier League games at the Etihad under Pep Guardiola.
Who? Palace, Wolves.
Nice, two.
Man United,
three. And last one.
And
give up?
For the sake of the silence that's taken over this podcast.
For the sake of dead air, which is obviously the cardinal sin of podcasting. Antonio Conte's Chelsea.
Oh, yeah.
Because Conte's the only manager, I think, to do the double for Mourinho in a season. No, it was 3-1.
Remember, De Bruyne had that big miss, and then Chelsea went to...
He's, in fact, the first team. Obviously, I said Chelsea don't match the profile, which might appear to be a curious remark, given that they are literally on the list of teams. But it feels like a different side.
That was a totally different team.
Those teams, these are all teams who scored their goals at the Etihad through pretty direct means. We saw the counterattacks from Wolves and Antonio Conte's Chelsea were specialists in counterattacking football. High balls into the box from a Manchester United team that enjoyed a very rare second half masterclass from Alexis Sanchez. who crosses into the box.
Yeah, and Herrera,
be though from
and
the Herrera, flanks or,
they
or,
had Herrera, Pogba, yeah, and Alexis all play well for like half a game for the first time ever.
Yeah. And then Crystal Palace, there was the worldie, as you mentioned, from Townsend.
Andros Townsend,
their
power
first
hour.
Goal came from nowhere. It was a Van Aanholt one.
Yeah.
And they played far more pragmatically than we'd expect to see Lampard's Chelsea play this Saturday, even if you wouldn't fully expect them to be as gung-ho as they have been on previous other occasions. But here's where the situation I mentioned actually plays in Chelsea's favour, because another thing all those defeats more or less had in common is that they were preceded by other bad results. Not directly, but within a fairly recent space of time, City had also experienced bad results. They've just lost to Liverpool, of course, in their last game.
Yeah.
Wolves beat them not long after the shock away defeat to Norwich. Palace won at the Etihad just 3 games after Chelsea, Sarri's Chelsea, had beat them at Stamford Bridge. And the Manchester United win that delayed them winning the title at the Etihad in their Centurion season 2017-18. Both followed and preceded defeats to Liverpool in the Champions League quarterfinal. And they'd also fairly recently lost to Wigan and Basel in the space of a month at that point. And there's also like a Russian doll element to this. I said theory is a grandiose term, but I kind of went too far with this one, definitely.
Deep dives in Will Hall.
There's a Russian doll element to this because, yes, bad results come in batches for Guardiola City. Also, in each of those defeats, City conceded twice in quick succession within 10 minutes or fewer. The Palace goals were quite close together. I think there was only like 5 minutes or so splitting them. Mm. The two Pogba goals that they scored to come back from 2-0 down were quite quick. And I'm pretty sure it's the case with the Wolves one, yeah, because they scored in the 80th minute.
Yeah. Even in the Champions League against Spurs last season, their son basically finished them off in the first like 20 minutes.
And I think my flowery interpretation of why this is the case is because we've come to know City as the masters of maintaining control for long periods of time, controlling possession in games, these record-breaking win streaks that they've amassed in the Premier League that Liverpool fell narrowly short of doing so themselves, of course. But perhaps when they're denied that control, it takes a while for them to reclaim it. And that creates a window in which you can damage them. And Chelsea have got this window right now. Basically, the two things I just explained cancel each other out, in my view. So I think it will be like a 2-2 draw.
Okay. A squawker special.
And I think, I've got to uphold that tradition.
Jacob will be proud.
But City's next games are against, I think they've got Newcastle and Burnley away. And those are two teams who do really match the profile of the sort of counter-attacking. I think Newcastle this season have had more fast breaks than any other team.
Well, they lost to Newcastle last season, didn't they?
Yeah. The late penalty. So maybe the slip-ups could come there. But another reason I think Chelsea could get a result here is that statistically, they are one of, if not the most outright, best attacking teams on the road in the Premier League this season so far. They've scored 18 goals, which is the most. And then widening that data pool a little, Chelsea have had more shots on target away from home than any Premier League team this season, with 45 to City's 43. And the flip side of this, which is why I think it will be a score draw, is Chelsea's defensive record for one.
Yeah,
the save percentage is quite poor.
They don't let many shots on goal, but when they do, Kepa just lets them go.
Yeah, well, shots on goal, I think they've faced 35 shots overall, but 25 have come on the road. And they've only Newcastle, Aston Villa and Watford have conceded more away goals than Chelsea, who've let in 12. Four of those came against Manchester United, of course. And then the other fact is, although they have got this quite strong attacking record away from home, if you consider the teams they have played, they haven't been super tough fixtures since that defeat at Manchester United.
Basically, you nailed it on there where you said that when you hit City, there's a vulnerability. That's one thing I've always said about Pep City is they don't have what his Barca and Bayern have, which was this absurd conviction of their ability to control games. So there is always periods in games where you can hit them and make them wobble, and they take a while to recover, as you say. And I do think that's kind of what will happen. That's why I think Kovacic will score and everything. But I don't think, I then think, contrary to you two, your draws, playing it safe, I think City are going to come back, get the win, and go within, like, I don't know, less points.
I think I'm being bold with a draw, actually.
A draw would seem a very good result for
City,
Chelsea.
City must be pretty heavy favourites. It's Guardiola City against Lampard Chelsea his first season there. And it's going to be a very young Chelsea side.
It is true.
I think the question of whether Ederson plays will obviously... I think he's expected to start, Guardiola's being a bit,
yeah, I think so,
a bit vague. And
yeah, I suppose if Bravo plays, that does kind of...
I'm confident Edison will play.
If Bravo plays, that changes everything.
There was another pattern in those defeats.
Oh, here we go.
I think Otamendi featured in all of them.
Or Rust Cole, calm down.
Was, yeah. What was that, that Always Sunny bit with Charlie and his theory in the post office that became a meme? Anyway,
with the post office.
And Otamendi was quite bad in those games. And I think he's expected to play. But yeah.
Well, my scoreline prediction is 1-1. I don't have any huge theories to back up my prediction.
So you're Marty then. You're the more down to earth kind. We've got Russ Cole over here.
Oh, I've just got the reference. If Jake was here, he would have had a go at you for that.
Yes, probably.
And then 5 minutes later, as I did, I would have remembered the reference and then regretted not backing you up with an acknowledgement of it.
True Detective season 1. Watch it weekend. It's very good.
Okay, that's all our predictions locked in. We'll be adding some of those to this week's BetBall Acca. Now it's time for another quick break before we talk about Sheffield United and Manchester United. We've got a United derby of sorts on our hands on Sunday when Sheffield United host Manchester United. Just 1 point and 2 places separate the two sides after 12 games. That in itself is a turn up for the books. Most people, myself included, were back in Chris Wilder's side to struggle to stay in the division, but they're flying high in a Europa League place, while the Red Devils seem to still be lacking a bit of direction under Solskjaer. Now, Mo, you've been banging the Chris Wilder drum for at least a couple of weeks.
To put it mildly.
So what do you think the Blades have that the other promoted Premier League teams don't have? Why are they doing so well this season?
They shocked me, first of all. I have to put my hand up and say I thought they were going to get toasted, and they've been amazing. And I think it's because they have such a coherent and established system of play, a pattern of play. Like when you come up from the championship. What if you have a system of defined way of playing, it makes you so much harder to play because it's the quality gap is reduced. Solid systems of play and well-established patterns of play. If you know how to play football, then it's not just about how good you are as an individual. It's about how your team works collectively. Like, you look at Aston Villa, it's a bunch of individuals, essentially. It's like, give it to Grealish and pray, almost, sometimes. And they try to work certain methods and patterns.
I don't think that's fair. I think Dean Smith's... He's done
very well, but it's not...
cohesive view.
It's not the same because they've bought loads of players as well, and it's like trying to fit everything together and make a new team. Sheffield United haven't bought that many, and they have what they have is and Norwich is a great example of almost how a system of play can help you because they've played very well, but ultimately quality does tell because like Norwich have played very well, they played very well most of their games, and they beat City of course, but quality, they keep losing games. What Sheffield United have got is what Norwich haven't got is a solid defence, and so they've got a solid defence and a coherent system of play that makes them very dangerous. They should have beat Liverpool. They outplayed Liverpool and lost to a hilarious defensive mistake. But the fact that they were even, forget outplaying, the fact they were even on the same pitch as Liverpool in terms of like competing with them, that's ridiculous because Liverpool are an amazing side, as we've all said multiple times. And they really competed with them with this system, which is this unique system. It's back three, but the centre backs overlap and the full backs sort of tuck in and help out defensively. It's quite something to watch, and they've had 334. This is the thing: as much as they are fun to watch with the ball, they are very good defensively, and that's part of why they are where they are. They've had 5 clean sheets, which is I think one of the joint most in the Premier League. They've got 334 clearances, which is the first among all teams in Premier League. 149 interceptions, which is third. 716 passes into the final third, which is second. Only Liverpool have more than them. So they're getting it forward quickly in the same kind of way that Liverpool are, really. They use their fullbacks, use their wide players to get the ball forward fast. Oliver Noor is playing well as well in the middle of the park. And when you get the ball forward quickly, it unsettles defences. They don't know how to deal with it. You look at, contrast them to Man United, right, for instance. They're the two highest ranked Uniteds in the league. Man United don't have anything approaching a system of play. The idea is just either get it to Rashford and let him one-on-one, get to try to play James in behind, or what? There's nothing else. There's no idea. Like, especially without Pogba. Before it was just get to Pogba and pray. Now he's not even there. they play well, don't get me wrong, because they've got good players, but that's why they play well. Do you know what I mean? They're not playing well because they have an understanding of where they are supposed to stand and what they're supposed to do. Everything's off the cuff. That's why their best performance recently was when Juan Mata played as a number 10, and because, you know, and he had one of his rare good games. That's the thing, right? When you have a number 10 that you can pass the ball to and play through, like Juan Mata, it can lift you as a side, but the number 10 has to do it regularly. And that's why they tried to sign Dybala, Eriksen and Maddison in the summer, because they know that. And Mata is good, but Mata can't do it every week. So, they're inconsistent most of the time. Jesse Lingard is not a number 10, by the way. Like, in terms of an offensive number 10. He's a great defensive number 10. He'll press and he'll mark a defensive midfielder, and he can even score you some goals occasionally, although not, like, for ages now. But
bringing it back to Sheffield United.
Yeah.
After Man United, they have some very winnable games in the build-up to Christmas. They've got Wolves,
yeah,
Newcastle, Norwich, Villa, Brighton, Watford. Then, granted, they have an absolute beast of a January where they have to play Man City twice, I think, Arsenal as well. But they could be looking at almost reaching the 30-point mark by Christmas, which is one hell of an achievement, isn't it, really? But then my worry for them would be, you're talking about the style of play. I always feel like when you're a newly promoted side, the first half of the season is almost like a free shot, because everyone is going to treat you like a newly promoted side for that first half of the season.
Yeah.
But once everyone's played them once, the second time is maybe where they'll find it a bit harder, because people will come with a bit of a better plan, rather than just say, oh, we can just take on Sheffield United and play how we usually play and beat them.
Mm.
They'll have to change tactics.
Well, that's going to be interesting to see, is how do teams react to them now? Because like they have such a defensive system. They shut Liverpool down, for example. Liverpool obviously play wide through their fullbacks, and so Sheffield United just shut down their fullbacks. And as a result, Liverpool couldn't really generate that much. They still had a couple of very nice chances. Salah didn't really make the most of. But so you wonder, maybe, like, for example, like, do you then start playing through the middle of the pitch a bit more? Do you try and chest them there? John Egan is very good with the ball, but looks a bit unsteady when he's backtracking. Liverpool put him on the ground a few times and could have gotten in behind, but for some good work from Chris Basham and the like. So, you know, there's weaknesses there to be exploited. So you have to wonder if you diagnose them correctly. But, you know, you look at United, and I think it'd be interesting. This game, I think, would be very, very defensive, I think, because Sheffield United don't concede many chances. They don't concede many goals. I mean, they have Dean Henderson has made 34 saves this season, which is 8th. He's got a 78.57 save percentage, which is 3rd in the Premier League. He's been brilliant, and he's got 5 clean sheets, as I said, but he's not playing because this is where I think Man United gained an advantage, because I think if Henderson was playing, I think you would have backed. I know he had that error against Liverpool, but honestly, apart from that, he's been brilliant this season. And I think if you watched the Liverpool game, you would think, with Henderson in there, they would just shut down United and they would pick them off when they wanted to. And even with the ball, they could probably come out and play through United, because United aren't as... The defence is very good, Man United's, but the midfield is kind of... it's okay. It's, you know, it's better since Fred and McTominay have formed a sort of partnership, but ultimately it is still Fred and McTominay. And there's a good chance Andres Pereira plays, and Andres Pereira's a worker, but like... You know, he's not much more than that, really. I mean, he can take a decent set piece every now and again. But without Henderson, you lose that solid... But we've seen it with City. Without your goalkeeper, and it sounds ridiculous, because obviously without your solid goalkeeper who can make saves, who can pass, who can do everything your system requires of him, you lose a lot. You lose a lot of stability, and it's just this uncertainty. So now, you know, Man United could have maybe like 2-3 shots on goal, and maybe they'd score them now, instead of maybe Henderson would repel them. So I actually think Man United will win this 1-0. I think it'll be very cagey, very defensive. I think Sheffield United will rebuff Man United's attacks. I think Man United will rebuff Sheffield United's attacks, because Man United do have Man United have 3 very good defenders, and then left back is a menagerie of you know, blandness. And the potential of that. Brandon Williams has potential. I like him a lot, but like he's not like...
I think he's looked all right.
He's a battler. He's not a top-tier like talent, maybe, but he's a battler. Ashley Young is just whatever, man. If you're not man-marking a top-class player, what is he even good for these days? And then Luke Shaw is
he's club captain.
And Luke Shaw is a sad, just a sad waste of talent, really, at this point. It's not even funny to make fun of him, to be honest. It's just a shame, because he could have been one of the great left-backs around in the whole world, really. If you look at him back when he was 19 playing for Poch at Saints, you're thinking, wow, this guy's going to be the next big thing. But whatever. So yeah, United have got Harry Maguire's been brilliant, Wan-Bissaka's brilliant, De Gea's okay, he's having a decent season, So I think they'll shut down Sheffield United's attacks as well. I think it will be heading towards a 0-0. And I think Marcus Rashford is playing immensely at the moment. I think a bit of movement from him, bit of play from Martial or something, they'll link up, get a goal, Man United win it 1-0, nick it 1-0. But Sheffield United will rebound, obviously, and carry on playing well. As you said, they've got a really easy run of fixtures. But I think Man United will have just a bit too much quality. Rather than any sort, there won't be any tactical cohesion thing. It'll just have a bit too much individual quality, which has been Sheffield United's downfall in some of the bigger games, you know. But, I mean, I would love to see Sheffield United with better players. I mean, it sounds an insult to the players they have, but with better quality players. Like, I wish they could, you know, they could go out and sign like some, even just mid-tier quality Premier League players. I think they could do so much with that.
We did, we updated an old article that we produced on how Sheffield United could line up if they hadn't sold their best players, like Walker and like people who went on to become superstars. Yeah. And there were actually quite a few comments on that from Sheffield United fans saying there genuinely aren't that many players in the team right now that they would swap back for bigger names.
It's so cohesive. Yeah. It's so cohesive.
I think that's, I just wanted to make
that point. No. I'm not saying that the players are rubbish and they should all go. I have massive admiration for Sheffield United. I was one of the people pre-season was like, they're done. They're not good enough. But it's not about being good enough, is it? It's about how cohesive the system is. And the system has shown that you can confound people. The one thing that I think may give United an edge is that United don't have a defensive system.
Which United?
Oh, yeah, sorry. The one thing that will give Man United...
The United.
The one thing... Well, Sheffield United would argue, wouldn't they? One thing that will give Manchester United a little edge, I think, is obviously the quality and the fact that maybe also the fact that they don't have a defined system of play to shut down. Like Sheffield United, they shut down Liverpool because Liverpool had a defined way of playing. They knew what to do. How do you game plan for a team that doesn't really have a game plan itself? Do you know what I mean? It's like you just sort of like, okay, let's just defend. But defend what? Like, so I do think United will have enough quality just to nick the win in the end. But I think Sheffield United are an exceptional side and hooray for them.
It's definitely another game that Solskjaer has everything to lose. There's going to be some very unflattering headlines if they don't get it done.
He has to prove that, because they got the good result against Brighton in their last game, and he has to prove this isn't another like mini revival that's just going to dip again, because that has kind of been the story of their season so far. These promising results have been followed by disappointing results.
They've played well when Martial has been fit is the story of the season so far, really. So if Martial can stay fit, that's a huge thing for them, because then it means Rashford plays left wing and that just brings the whole side into a better shape. But if Martial gets injured again, or they don't sign a backup in January, they're in trouble.
Okay, that's all we have time for today. Although I get the feeling that Mo could have waxed lyrical about Chris Wilder long into the night. So thanks from me, and thanks from our guests Will and Mohammed, and of course thanks to our sponsors BetBall. Don't forget to download their app if you are over 18 and gambling responsibly. We'll catch you next week.